Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Numbers gathered at the Centers for Disease Control tell us that the highest prevalence of being diagnosed with depression is among young adults between 18 and 24. Among the 10 states with the highest prevalence is Kentucky, second only to West Virginia. And one place where this issue and mental health issues in general can be closely observed is in our schools. So we begin at the top rung of the educational ladder, our college campuses. Gil Hunter, Assistant Vice President for Retention and Graduation here at EKU, also volunteers his time as an Eastern Standard Education contributor.
There's a national conversation around student mental health and well-being as schools and colleges seek to support students in ways that both influence and go beyond their work in the classroom. In her role as Dean of Students at Eastern Kentucky University, Dr. Laura Vance has worked with a wide range of students and is on the leading edge of student mental health advocacy and intervention. Dr. Vance has taken a break from that work right now to join me today to talk about student mental health. Dr. Vance, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start here. We've heard that the national conversation is happening about the increasing prevalence of mental health, quote unquote, problems, maybe especially during and since the pandemic, but I don't know if we really attribute it to the pandemic. But in the big picture, why is mental health, especially among students, being paid more attention to, or why is, if we can say it, student mental health worse now at this time?
Well, I think that both can be true, Dr. Hunter. I think that mental health did take a turn during the pandemic. I certainly think that the pandemic has had quite an impact on the mental health of everyone. But, you know, today we're talking about young adults, college students. So I think that certainly there are issues that we can attribute to the pandemic that increase that. The isolation, the lack of social involvement, the lack of structure in schools during that time. But I also think that we were seeing the increase in issues and concerns pre-pandemic. Certainly, our counseling center's numbers indicate that that was happening as their number of clients and appointments was going up prior to the pandemic. I do also think, though, that we're talking about it more. And I think that the stigma has been lessened somewhat so that it's okay to talk about it. And we're seeing celebrities talk about their help and the help that they get with counselors. It's being discussed, their entire podcast that celebrities have about mental health and that support. And so I think the more that people were talking about it and alleviating that stigma about getting mental health support, the more that our college students are seeking out that help too and talking about it themselves.
In your role as Dean of Students, you know, you're not living on social media with students. You've got students coming in your office. You're going, reaching out to students. But what's the world look like right now?
It is, and I'm careful in how I frame this up because, you know, I want to say students lack resilience, but I don't want to come across as implying that people should just tough it out, because, you know, in mental health, there are real challenges and there are professionals out there to provide help and support. Part of that is helping a student recognize when a certain resource would help them, or helping a student recognize that this is healthy stress. Of course, you're going to be stressed before you have a big exam. That's not a bad thing. It's when, okay, you're not sleeping, you're self-medicating, you're doing unhealthy things in order to cope with stress, when we want to help them find that sense of resilience. And certainly in my role, I need to make sure that I'm getting students to professional help when they need it. And that's often the case. By the time they are sitting in front of me, they may really need a professional counselor to help them.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
They may need to see, we have a psychiatric nurse practitioner on campus, so maybe they need to see somebody about some medications and support in that way. But it's not always that, though. Sometimes they just need the reassurance that things are stressful, but that's okay. And there are people here to help you and to let them know that part of being an adult is asking for help.
We spend a lot of time on a college campus talking about students being adults now, that parents don't have kind of a direct impact. But this seems like touchy territory. So what role do parents play in your experience with students as dean of students? Do you bring them into the conversation? Do you say, no, I can't discuss any of this with you? How's that work?
You know, it's going to depend on the circumstances. Students legally have a right to privacy. If a student is having mental health concerns to the effect that I'm concerned about their well-being, I'm concerned about their life, then legally I can contact their caregivers, whoever that is, whether that's parents or somebody else.
Sure.
What I appreciate is sometimes parents will contact us and say, I'm worried about my student, and they haven't been themselves lately. And nobody knows that student better than their caregivers, their loved ones. And so when they're drawing our attention to something and we can reach out to the student, offer them some resources and support, then that's very beneficial. And that's a real partnership with parents that we can do.
Yeah. So is it a partnership also that parents seem to want? Like, what role do parents expect us as a university to play?
That's going to vary from parent to parent. And I've seen parents that are like, nope, you're an adult now, you figure this out. Mm. And I've seen some that really want to swoop in and, you know, take them to the counseling center themselves, or see their grades in real time and those updates. And finding that middle ground, I've joked that it was so much easier raising toddlers than it was raising young adults as a parent myself, because they really can go off and be an adult and do their own thing. And there's not a whole lot I can do about it. But just loving them, providing them with that support and that encouragement, letting them know that you don't expect them to have it all figured out.
Sure, sure. We hear about people taking chances to work on their mental health. That's a phrase that I hear used a lot. You need to work on your mental health. Be sure you work on your mental health. In your experience as dean of students, what does that mean?
I mean, that could run a spectrum of, well, you need to think about it and think about taking care of yourself and working on your sleep schedule and actually eating right. And, you know, yes, you're in college, you can eat whatever you want. That doesn't mean that you should eat whatever you want.
Right.
It doesn't mean that you should stay up until 3 o'clock in the morning and only get 3 hours of sleep. I mean, it was one of those like badges of honor when I was in college. Oh, I only got 3 hours of sleep last night. No, that's not good. And that's not healthy. But it can also range to maybe you need to stop and take a semester off to get some more intensive treatment and some more specified help. You know, our capacity is only so much. And when we're really overwhelmed, when we're really struggling with our mental health, it's difficult to sit in a classroom. And we put pressure on students to get out of college in a certain amount of time to get their degree so that they can become, you know, contributing members in our society. And that's great, but that road is different for everyone. And so we need to make sure that students don't feel like they're failing out of college if they need to take time to get support, whether that by working on their mental health, that means getting on medication and working with a doctor to make sure that that's right, to figuring out what path that they want to be on while they're in college, or, you know, getting therapy for past trauma so that their capacity enlarges.
Given that, let me finish with this question. If that's the working on mental health that we're talking about, then what can we as educators, parents, friends, other people do to help high school students, college students, young adults, anybody around us maybe? What can we do to help them do that work?
listen. I mean, that's the number one thing that we can do for them is listen and validate them. When they come to you and they're stressed out and they're talking about their stress saying, oh, I mean, you don't know stress until, you know, you've experienced this. We need to validate the feelings that they're having. Even if we're helping them work on their resilience, that doesn't mean that doesn't feel real to them.
Sure. Yeah. Resilience is not just plowing through.
Exactly. It's reflecting on why do I feel this way and what can I do to help alleviate some of what I'm feeling. And so I think listening and validating and then making sure that we're helping connect them to the resources that will provide them with the best support. And whether that's counseling, whether that's a mentor, whether that's a new major, no matter what that is, helping them find that by listening to them.
So I've been talking with Dr. Laura Vance, Dean of Students at Eastern Kentucky University, about student mental health. Dr. Vance, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for your time too, sir.
Now, down that age level ladder that I mentioned and into our high, middle, and elementary schools and the launch of a new series on youth mental health hosted by Terry Brooks, Executive Director of Kentucky Youth Advocates. His guest, Dr. Tommy Wells, who holds degrees in educational leadership and policy, counseling and counselor education, and educational psychology. He's an assistant professor of education at Bellarmine University in Louisville.
So as we continue our discussions around the challenges of mental health in Kentucky's kids, we absolutely have to think about how that plays out in a school setting. Dr. Wells, as someone who is an old, retired, broken-down principal, I think about what I saw for years, and you certainly had emotional issues, behavioral issues, forever in schoolhouses. But I think it's safe to say that they have been exacerbated, maybe even exploding. And I'm wondering if you would give us your landscape of exactly what educators are facing in this area today.
Yes. So I'm a teacher educator. So I'd like to share some of the concerns that my teachers have seen. For example, one who is an elementary school teacher shared that she is seeing student overreactions to directions, redirections, issues with adjusting to this classroom environment, being able to focus, and with building and maintaining relationships with peers and teachers. Some of my other teachers have seen meltdowns surrounding changes to the school and classroom schedule and upcoming school breaks, as well as a struggle to regulate emotions. And then from my conversations with my colleagues who are school counselors and school psychologists, they are seeing an increase in mental health issues in students, such as on anxiety, a lack of coping skills to navigate through the school day successfully, school refusal where students don't want to come to school, and family stressors such as job loss, domestic violence, divorce, and substance abuse. Finally, they're also seeing an increased need to evaluate students for suicidal ideation. And then finally, I just read an article a few days ago from WBEZ Chicago, their NPR news station, and the mental health crisis they are seeing specifically in girls, where almost 60% of high school girls in the U.S. felt persistent feelings of sadness and hopelessness. Nearly 20% had experienced sexual violence, and 25% had made a suicide plan. And then in addition to the student concerns, the article also described how one in five schools had unfilled jobs for mental health workers and how very few school districts meet the recommended ratios of students to school psychologists and school counselors. And while some state and federal lawmakers have invested in hiring and training for more mental health providers, it may take years for the workforce to grow enough to meet the demand. So there aren't enough mental health professionals, particularly who are licensed, as well as inadequate funding to hire and support these staff members.
So schools find themselves in a little bit of a vexing situation. Kentucky's numbers, for instance, tell us that 70% of Kentucky's fourth graders do not read at a minimally proficient level. 80% of Kentucky's eighth graders don't do math at a minimal national proficiency level. So schools definitely feel that academic pressure to achieve in a high-stakes testing environment. And yet, I'm guessing your hypothesis is like mine, which is if we don't address mental and emotional health needs, we're never going to get to reading comprehension or multiplication. What role can schools play when you think about mental health for kids?
I think schools can take a more systematic approach to supporting students' mental health, similar to how many schools and districts already support students academically and behaviorally, which is through the framework of multi-tiered systems of supports, or MTSS. An MTSS is a framework that emphasizes data-driven decision-making at various tiers of support to meet students' needs across academic, behavioral, and social and emotional learning domains. And the goal is to mitigate challenges that students may experience by providing interventions at the earliest signs of difficulty. MTSS is structured in three tiers. So tier one is for universal supports for all students with strategies and practices implemented in the general education environment. Tier two is for target interventions, where students who require additional support beyond the universal level are given support often in small groups. And then tier three is for intensive interventions. And at this level, students receive individualized support that includes family involvement and referrals to community partners. Schools are also seeing success when teachers and staff are trained to be more aware of students' needs and trained on effective classroom practices to create a safe and supportive learning environment. For example, teachers can focus on improving aspects of the classroom environment, such as creating daily routines and structures that foster a sense of safety. And this can be having a routine for entering the classroom and acknowledging every student each day, a bell ringer or initial activity that gives students an opportunity to share how they're feeling or connect to others. And then other aspects, such as having a daily agenda on the board, using a timer so students can learn how to manage their time effectively in the classroom, and having processes in place for simple things such as turning in work or asking to go to the restroom, so students always know expectations. And then teachers can also focus on developing positive relationships with all students and treating them with unconditional positive regard. Unconditional positive regard can be defined as showing support and acceptance of a person no matter what the person says or does. And for teachers, this means giving students a fresh start each day. However, when students demonstrate that they do need more support than what the classroom teacher can offer, then students can be offered tier two support. And I think schools are still figuring out the best way to identify students for tier two and tier three, whether that be through a referral from the students themselves, from families, or from teachers, or a more standardized approach through an SEL screener given to all students that might flag students who need more support. And tier two will look differently based on what schools and districts can offer. And the support will often come through the school's social workers, school counselors, and school psychologists, who will often provide small group counseling or social skills groups that focus on specific topics, such as managing grief, building self-esteem, or learning new coping skills. An example of a program that can be used in Tier 2 is Working on Womanhood, which is a school-based counseling and mentoring program to help Black and Latina girls who have experienced high levels of trauma. And as described in that same WBEZ article I mentioned earlier, while there was no significant drop in mental health diagnoses compared to girls not in the program, these students did report fewer symptoms of anxiety, depression, and PTSD. And then finally, if students still demonstrate further need, they can be offered tier three support, which often entails individual counseling, personalized learning plans, family support, and referrals to community partners, such as referrals for mental health counseling. And I will say that in addition to providing training and support for teachers on supporting students' mental health, such as training in an SEL curriculum or coaching for creating a strong sense of belonging in the classroom, your school social workers, counselors, and school psychologists might also need training and support.
You're really suggesting a culture where every student gets attention around behavioral and mental health. That might involve culture. It might involve routines within the classroom. And then depending upon particular individual needs, they get some additional supplemental support, or at the other end, it's pretty intense. Is that a good way to picture what you're describing here?
Yes, that's a great summary.
Okay. So you've mentioned both ethnicity and gender. I would assume that part of your thinking about this issue is that equity is an important element in customizing and targeting supports? First of all, is that accurate? And then secondly, can you talk a little bit about the issue of equity in this area for kids?
Yes, I think equity plays a major role in supporting mental health, in that every district will have their own priorities, resources, and values. And mental health initiatives start up at top with school administrators and school boards who value and promote a whole child approach to educating their students and want to ensure that students' mental health is supported and improved along with academic outcomes. And as I mentioned earlier, districts often lack the funding for adequate hiring and training of mental health providers for their schools and will have to determine where to allocate the funding they have. And at the school level, if a school only has one social worker, for example, that social worker will have to decide who receives service, meaning that some students who need support likely won't get it from the school. And as schools begin collecting more data on students' mental health, then they'll be able to begin to track which students are thriving the most and which students are more likely to need support. And with more data on students' mental health, perhaps schools can advocate more successfully for additional funding and resources.
So an area that I tend to think people don't think about enough, whether it's in frontline social workers or workers in the early childhood setting, folks who are employed in the juvenile justice system, or public school educators, is that it would seem that educators have to be intentional around self-care for them to deliver care for students. That seems like that's a very under-discussed and under-emphasized element of this whole area. Can you talk a little bit about that and offer some observations?
Yes, I believe self-care is very important in creating and sustaining a healthy school environment. And we're thinking about educators, and we know that there are individual choices that educators can make about their own self-care in terms of their physical and mental health, as well as social activities and support from their families that they may need. But work-life balance is definitely part of that picture and the largest concern that many teachers I've talked to have had. I also recognize that teachers are consistently asked to do more in their role, which is causing issues for them to be able to take care of themselves. And while we may have school leaders who say that their teachers need to set boundaries for work-life separation, school leaders then also need to respect those boundaries, as well as determine tasks that can be taken off teachers' plates whenever possible so that teachers can maintain those boundaries. For example, school leaders might be able to think about taking away lunch or hallway duties, having fewer staff meetings, or creating school-wide expectations that emails aren't sent or responded to after the end of school day.
So, Tommy, I know that you're coming at this from both a practitioner but also an academician's perspective. One thing that I'm curious your observation, especially from a national perspective, are political ramifications. Increasingly, I'm reading and hearing that this arena, which even just a couple of years ago was pretty commonly accepted as a need, is again sort of sitting into those bifurcation lines that public schools are encountering. Do you see this still as a common ground commitment, or is it becoming partisan and polarized as one of those many, many issues in public education that seemingly divides us rather than unites us?
From what I've heard from my teachers who are in the classroom, there has been some pushback in some areas, while in others there is more support, particularly around SEL. But I think when it comes to local schools' decisions, if you have the community and families involved in your decision-making on how to best support students' mental health, such as working together to select an SEL curriculum and what supports the school should provide to the students, then it doesn't become such a contentious issue. And the teachers I've spoken to have felt supported by their families because the students and families are asking for the support. They want more resources from the school. So I think it can be something that schools can work together with the community and with families to ensure that they're doing what's best for students.
So what I'm hearing is a smart precedent is engage parents and engage communities before you launch a focus on this area. That's going to avoid some problems coming up later.
Yes, I believe that's the best first step, is to gather the feedback from your stakeholders.
So give us the download and remind us why this is so important. If I'm a listener and I want to talk to a lawmaker about investing in this area in the 2024 budget, what are the points that I should be making with that state representative or state senator?
I think the major point is if we focus on students' mental health as much as we focus on academic and behavioral outcomes, what we'll notice is that we're taking a whole child approach to education that will ultimately lead to better student outcomes across all domains. If we focus on students' mental health and decreasing the symptoms that they have and giving them the support that they need, then they'll be able to focus more in the classroom and learn more from their teachers. And that will lead to higher grades, better test scores, and better outcomes and opportunities after high school graduation. So the main thing to take away and to offer to your lawmakers is if we can support students' mental health, they will do better academically and will have better prepared students to become citizens in our society.
Coming up after the break, getting funding to the front lines of the opioid epidemic. A play about the many reasons to live and celebrating the trees that help us calm our minds and lower our blood pressure. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is WEKU Arts reporter Sherry Lawson with coming events from Kentucky Humanities. On Monday, October 2nd, the Clark County Public Library in Winchester will host Kentucky Chautauqua, Gene Ritchie, Damsel with a Dulcimer. The show will begin at 7 p.m. On Tuesday, October 3rd, Alice Lloyd College in Pippa Passes will host Kentucky Chautauqua, Alice Lloyd, Stay On, Stranger. This program will begin at 1 p.m. And on Wednesday, October 4th, Big Sandy Community and Technical College in Prestonsburg will host Speakers Bureau, Singing in the Spirit, the African American Sacred Music Tradition, presented by Kathy Bullock. The program will start at 1 p.m. I'm Sherry Lawson, now back to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Having a big impact on our mental health as a society, addiction to opioids, fentanyl, and other drugs, both legal and illegal. Marianne Smith Edge chairs the Foundation for a Healthy Kentucky Board of Directors. And Marianne joins us to talk about the Funding for Recovery, Equity, and Expansion, or FREE, Addiction Recovery Program. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Marianne.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on your program today.
So the Foundation for a Healthy Kentucky has partnered with the state's Kentucky Opioid Response Effort and its Office of Health Equity on this new grant program. Tell us about the grant program and about its goals.
Well, the FREE program, as you mentioned, is the Funding for Recovery, Equity, and Expansion grant program, which aims to reduce overdose deaths and improve the overall well-being of communities of color and under-resourced communities in Kentucky. You know, the ideal is for this and our goals is really that the Foundation for Healthy Kentucky will provide grants to nonprofits throughout the state for activities that will raise awareness about overdose prevention and hopefully reduce the stigma around substance abuse disorder and to improve access to harm reduction and recovery support services for people that have opioid and or stimulant use disorder.
Well, there's no doubt that we have a problem out there. Looking at data from the Federal Centers for Disease Control, and the numbers show that accidental overdose is now the top cause of death among people under 40 in 37 states, among them Kentucky. How does this program, Funding for Recovery, Equity, and Expansion, aim to reduce addiction and address that?
Well, this program is really designed to really look at programs that will address prevention and unhealth needs. And, you know, in the state, as you mentioned, it is a huge problem. And despite that we have seen overall deaths slightly going down in the state, it's the BIPOC, opioid, or stimulant users that are dying at a much higher rate than their white counterparts. And so the mission, at the foundation is really to reduce the health disparities. And this is one program that really is focused on addressing the populations where the need is the greatest.
Well, you know, small nonprofits can very easily become overwhelmed by all the hoops you have to jump through to apply for a grant, much less receive it. And I understand the FREE program addresses that and helps small nonprofits overcome those barriers. Is that correct? And how does it do that?
It is correct. And I would say that's probably one of the most exciting things about this program, how it is really designed to work with the grant awardees over the next 10 months. Because not only is the foundation, as I say, being the conduit between federal and state funds to the nonprofits within the communities, but it's also going to really help them on a one-to-one basis to ensure that they're successful and have a return on investment. As you mentioned, Tom, is that you're right. When nonprofits a lot of times apply for federal grants, it really is grants operate on a reimbursement basis, which makes it really difficult for small communities to operate. But the foundation here will provide funding up front to the grantees so the communities can really hit the ground running. And, you know, this really starts that way. They're not waiting 3 months or 5 months. It's an immediate. And as I mentioned, in addition to that, is that staff on the foundation, as well as the state partners, will really help the community organizations turn their passion into power. So the staff and the state partners will work with the communities to utilize their resources, build organization and capacity, and prepare for future growth. And this may be in the form of having meetings with the grantees to review and monitor financial records or program's outcome. And there'll also be collaborative workshops on infrastructure building and ultimately sustaining the program. You know, so many times, and I've worked with a variety of nonprofits from community, state, and nationally, is that programs get funded, but many times the success of that stops when the funding. And so the good news here is that with the grant and with the assistance of the foundation staff and state partners, it really will be about not only funding initially for the next 10 months, but also trying to build that sustainability of the program.
Well, you mentioned stigma, and that can be a real barrier to getting help. And I just wonder, why is there a need to reduce stigma around substance use disorder? Is it pretty prevalent in that area?
You know, I think studies would and statistics would say that it is. And oftentimes you see that, especially in more the BIPOC communities, there may be more the stigma around the substance abuse disorder or not addressing it and not going for help. And so the ideal here is really how hopefully that communities have been creative and nonprofits to really think about how can we reduce these barriers and really bring about prevention programs, but also making sure that the doors are open, that people feel comfortable seeking help when needed.
All right, that's Mary Ann Smith Edge, board chair at the Foundation for a Healthy Kentucky. Thank you, Mary Ann.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Our next interview is about depression and suicide and could be triggering to some. The 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is a hotline for individuals in crisis or for those looking to help somebody in crisis. To speak with a trained listener, call or text 988. The EKU Psychology Clinic is hosting a play on Friday, September 29th and Saturday, September 30th, Every Brilliant Thing, themed on a young boy's experience of his mother's suicide attempt and a list he creates of every brilliant thing in the world as reasons for living. Brother Christian Mattson, a diocesan hermit of the Lexington Diocese, as well as a professional actor, is the driving force behind this production, and he's here with us on Eastern Standard. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
And just briefly, before we talk about the play, what is a diocesan hermit?
A diocesan hermit is a individual who has made vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience in the hands of the local bishop and who observes a rule of life under his direction, usually informed by some type of solitude, contemplative life, with some limited ministry as possible. And my ministry, with Bishop John Stowe's permission, is to continue working in the arts.
I was about to ask you what brought you to this production, but I guess that's a hint. But let me take that question further. How did you become involved in this particular production on this particular subject?
Well, I saw this show last year at San Luis Obispo Repertory Theater in California, and I went into the show knowing absolutely nothing about it. I just wanted to see what was at a local theater, and I was extremely moved by the show. I was laughing. I was crying. The thing that I most loved about the show is because there's so much audience interaction, it brings the audience together into a community of people. And they were partnering with a mental health organization, and we did the talk back afterward. And people were just sharing stories of grief, of loss, of their own suicidality, of their own depression. And I realized it made a community of people who are willing to share and find healing in that sharing. So I thought, this is absolutely the next show I want to do.
You mentioned audience participation. Tell us a bit more about that. How does that work in the play?
Sure. So it's a one-man show, and throughout the show, the main character is calling out numbers from his list. So he's made this list of every brilliant thing in the universe to live for, and he'll call out number one. And someone in the audience who's holding this card with number one on it will call out what's on the card, which is ice cream, or number two, water fights, or number 571, puppies, something like that. And so you're constantly involved with the actor, and the actor also pulls people up on stage to be different members of his family, his father, the school counselor he saw when he was a child. And those encounters allow audience members to share their own wisdom and participate in the show, and it ends up becoming, it's a very gentle form of audience interaction. It's very communal, and people end up cheering each other on. One of the performances we did in Pikeville, audience members were clapping for each other when they came down, you know, from finishing their performance. So it helps create a very warm bonding community during the course of the show.
Who really needs to come and see this?
I think anyone who has experienced moments of depression in their own life, anyone who knows anyone who's experienced depression or struggled with suicidality, which is pretty much everyone, there's a moment in the play where the main character says, if you live a long life and you get to the end of it without ever once having felt crushingly depressed, you probably haven't been paying attention. And one thing that we've noticed through doing these performances is people will come up to us after the show, either privately or in the Q&As that we do, and just say, I saw myself in the show, or I saw my husband, or I saw my mother, or there was a student who said, my sister attempted suicide, and now I understand how she must have felt. And so I think the show not only provides a moment of hope for people who have felt struggle in their own life, but also helps you understand how your friends or your family members who may have experienced deep moments of depression or attempted suicide or considered it, it helps you understand what they must have gone through.
The play is happening this weekend at EKU. If you could give us the details.
It's going to be in the O'Donnell Auditorium in the Whitlock Building on the EKU campus. It's free to members of the EKU community. Contact EKU for more information about the show. And it's only about an hour long. It's going to be at 7 p.m. Friday and Saturday evenings. And we're going to have talkbacks after each performance with a clinician from EKU Psychology Clinic so that people can talk about, you know, how the show impacts them, find out resources about how to help family members or friends or themselves who may be dealing with suicidality. And the number one resource I want to share is the 988 Lifeline, which we've referenced in the show, and we have materials to hand out after the show. That's a relatively new number that's just like 911 that you can call. Someone will pick up it every time. It's 24/7, free, confidential. You can just call 988 and you'll find someone who will listen to you.
You mentioned that this is primarily for the EKU community, but can anybody come even if they're not associated with EKU?
Absolutely. It's free to everyone. Just show up.
As Brother Christian Mattson, a diocesan hermit of the Lexington Diocese, a professional actor, and the driving force behind the production of the play, Every Brilliant Thing. And thanks so much.
Thank you.
Next week's edition of Eastern Standard will focus on untreated depression and high rates of suicide in the legal profession, revolving around the experience of a prominent Lexington attorney who recently attempted to end his life. Being around trees can be good for our mental well-being, and as it happens,
Tree Week is coming up, this annual time to recognize and think about these generators of oxygen, absorbers of carbon, providers of shade and habitats, and a whole lot more, is organized by the Urban Forest Initiative at UK's Martin Gatton College of Agriculture, Food, and Environment. And here with us to talk about this year's plants is Heather Wilson. She's an arborist and the Urban Forestry Program Manager with the Urban County Government in Lexington. Welcome, Heather.
Thanks.
So what is Tree Week?
It was born out of the Urban Forest Initiative Working Group, which is a broader collaboration of people throughout Lexington and our community that are focused on trees and increasing our urban canopy and all the ways that trees help us. And so Tree Week was an event basically that was born out of our desire to reach beyond our community. So we're not just always talking to ourselves, and to really reach out into the neighborhoods and create pathways for everyone through the community to recognize trees throughout the community and to connect with them in ways that really made more sense to them.
You know, often these special weeks or months grow out of a sense of imperative about something. It's felt that we need to make people more aware of something. Is that the genesis of Tree Week?
It is at the genesis of Tree Week, because I think that a lot of us understand, or we always hear the benefits of trees, like the ones that you mentioned in the beginning, but really getting people to understand them on a more personal level and want to plant trees and want to care for trees into their maturity, and really trying to help figure out ways to empower people to understand trees so that they're not afraid of them and that they know that trees grow and they're a vital part of our community and that each of us have a responsibility to help take care of them.
So this kicks off on October 6th, goes through the 15th, I believe.
It does.
And the kickoff event is in Castlewood Park, and you're going to be planting 4 trees there. And one reason is to increase tree canopy in District 1, the district in Lexington with the lowest percentage of canopy cover. How would an increased canopy benefit those neighborhoods?
Increased canopy provides a lot of social benefits to neighborhoods throughout the community. In Lexington, one of our biggest challenges is managing stormwater. And so trees help with that because not only do they absorb a lot of water as it hits the ground, but they also intercept all of that rain as it comes out of the sky. And so when it hits these bigger trees or even small trees, but the bigger the better, it impacts that canopy first, and then it slowly funnels down those leaves and those branches and down the trunk, and then slowly infiltrates the soil so that the soil can actually absorb it before it hits our waterways. Not only does that help prevent soil erosion, but it also helps prevent chemicals and other pollutants from getting into our waterways, like our town branch. It also helps to cool neighborhoods. And so a lot of the time, what you'll have is neighborhoods that are devoid of trees are 5 to 10 degrees hotter than neighborhoods that actually have trees. And that's a huge difference, you know, not even just for walking outside, but also for how well they help to cool houses, which means lowering our electricity bills and all those other bills that we spend money on just to live comfortably in our houses. Trees in neighborhoods also help to calm drivers. It helps to calm traffic flow as well as anxiety levels. It's also been shown to really help kids, like kids that have access to trees and just even being out under one tree and in the shade and connecting with nature, even in just a little way. It helps to lower rates of ADHD, anxiety, and helps focus more on schoolwork. I know that sounds a little far-fetched, but there's a lot of research out there that shows those connections. They create gathering places, you know, again, with that shade outside and the summer heat. Trees are often the place where communities can go and gather and have picnics or just, you know, hang out in under the shade if they're outside playing, or where parents can sit while their kids are running around. And even historically, trees were often markers for communities, like if they're traveling through different neighborhoods or through different cities, you know, you would have like the big oak that everyone knows to rest at because it's a good local spot where people connect with others or trade goods or just have a place that's safe to relax.
In addition to 9 week-long or ongoing events, mm-hmm. I also count more than 70 events, which are spread out over the week of October 6th through the 15th. Too many to go into detail here, but I thought we might highlight a few just to give our listeners an idea of what's planned. And the full schedule can be found online by Googling Tree Week 2023, and you'll see the Urban Forest Initiative site at or near the top of that Google page. And as I mentioned, there are literally dozens of events on the schedule. So let's take a sampling.
Some of the highlights that really have drawn me are some of actually those week-long events. I know you mentioned there's only a handful of those, but those are great because they're not limited to one day. There's a ton of library events that are happening throughout the week, and so they're listed out each day as well. And those are generally geared toward all ages, from little kids to adults. There's a climate conversations event that's happening again throughout the week. And that one's really kind of a choose your own adventure almost. The goal with that one is to have groups come together in areas that make sense to them, and then to note that back into the TruEEC map as to where those conversations happened. I think there's a really, really neat one at the African American Cemetery. It's kind of a history walk, and it's kind of told through trees. And so that happens Monday through Wednesday that week. And you'll learn, I think, a lot about the cemetery as well as the trees that were planted in that cemetery over the years.
I mentioned earlier that the whole idea is awareness. And so I'm just wondering, what are some important threats to trees and the ecosystems they support that we should be thinking about?
Thinking locally, some of the biggest threats to trees here is oftentimes construction, whether that's on private or public property. Oftentimes, trees wind up being impacted negatively when construction happens if they're not protected correctly. Also, sometimes they're not thought about in, let's say, in addition to your house, you know, and so all of a sudden the tree is in the way. And trying to figure out ways to accommodate for keeping trees for all the reasons that we've mentioned before and maybe building around them. Some of the other threats to trees here is obviously climate. As we're having these hotter summers and as our rain patterns are changing, it really does affect trees because they are living organisms, you know, and so sometimes those flowering events will come up, will be out of whack, and so we'll have fruit not necessarily happening when the pollinators are around. We'll also have early freezes or really late in the summer droughts. I don't know if you've noticed, but I've noticed a big change in the way that our rains come, and it really does impact trees. And generally, it kind of evens out in the fall. You know, like I know personally that I'll be like, oh my goodness, it's so hot and dry, and it's early for that. But then we'll get rains in October, and the trees seem to recover. But I have noticed over the past couple years how trees are having what's called a flush in the middle of the summer. So they're putting out new growth at times of the year that's not normal. It's because of these changing weather patterns. And then just individually, trees are impacted a lot by mechanical injury. So lawn mowers, weed eaters, vehicles parking over their root systems, particularly in parks, but also on private property. And I know it's really hard to see and to recognize that the root systems that are underground there are really heavily impacted by how much compaction happens on that soil right above them. And so basically, if you're driving over that, it's creating it to become almost concrete, especially when times of the year when it's moist outside and it just compresses all that soil. And a tree, if given the opportunity, the root system is two times the size of the canopy. And so while you might be, you know, 5 foot from the trunk of that tree, you don't necessarily realize that you're actually right on top of what's called the critical root zone of that tree. That matters because if they can't pull up oxygen out of the soil, if it's all been compressed out, then those roots cannot survive. And then the tree ultimately cannot survive.
That's important to know. And I'm wondering, many of us have homes with trees nearby, and occasionally branches get too close. They overhang the roof. They can get into the gutter system. Those kinds of things. And we're concerned about storms knocking down branches. How should we shop for a tree trimmer or pruner who's going to do it right?
That's a really great question. I always recommend that you find a local arborist company that has what's called an ISA, or International Society of Arboriculture Certified Arborist. This matters because that means the people that are coming to work on your trees understand the physiology of the tree, the biology of the tree, when a proper cut could be made, how to make a proper cut without causing more damage to the tree, because there is a right and a wrong way. And if you're making pruning cuts at the wrong location on a tree, you can actually cause that limb to become more hazardous than if you had left the limb on. And if you're working with a certified company, that means that you are getting good advice and ideally what is not only best for you, but also what is best for the tree and the longevity and the health of that, because that, again, comes back to being important to you as the homeowner, because that will keep you safest as well.
Well, I can't help but be curious about you, Heather. How were you drawn into work as an arborist and your interest in trees?
I discovered the Red River Gorge as a freshman in college from out of state. I was taken to the Red and always knew I loved the outside, the outdoors, working outside, and fell in love with the gorge and knew that I wanted to work and learn as much as I could about trees and how we keep trees safe. And so I went to the University of Kentucky. I wound up with my master's in forestry with a focus on ecology. And then out of college, I wound up working for a local arboricultural company and then as a technician for the city. And then after my master's and working for that company, coming back to the city to work in the urban forestry program as it had expanded. So, yeah, I just I love trees. I love not only what they do for us, all the benefits that we know, but I love the feeling that they give us. I love the sense of place that they give a location or they give a community. They're living beings, and understanding them is just, it's really, they're really amazing. And we're always learning more and more about them. I feel like with a lot of things, we always assumed we knew a whole lot, but it feels like in the past 10 years, our understanding of them as beings and of their role in our world is just, it's growing in leaps and bounds. And of all things on earth, trees take care of us.
Mm-hmm. They do. And you mentioned that they're beings, and there's some interesting research out there about communication among trees and the so-called mother tree in a forest that I really recommend. Again, just Google it, and you'll enjoy what you find, I'm pretty sure.
Yes, there's so much amazing research that's happening right now, trying to understand how they connect with each other and support each other. And not even just the mother tree to her progeny, but to other species around her.
That's Heather Wilson, Urban Forestry Coordinator with the Lexington Fayette Urban County Government. We're talking about Tree Week, which happens October 6th through the 15th, not just in Lexington, but let me throw this in, where else?
It is in Paducah, and it's in Somerset and Versailles and in Georgetown and Berea and Bowling Green and Frankfort and Louisville this year. But we have grown. It started in Lexington 6 years ago, and in the past three, it's really expanded. I feel like the year that we all had to socially distance is really when we kind of went beyond just Lexington, because everyone was looking for ways to engage with the outdoors safely. And Tree Week just kind of created this really great connection for communities to be outdoors and to each other. And so it's really been great.
It's really amazing how it's expanded. Well, thank you so much for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer. Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org. And there you can check out the Eastern Standard Archive, our series, our partners, and more. And you can sign up for our weekly newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard online at weku.org, on the WEKU app, and anywhere you get podcasts, including Apple and Spotify. And if you would like to call something to our attention or suggest a topic, our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.